you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So glad to be with you today. Boy, am I particularly glad to be with you today. Monday morning, I woke up, wasn't feeling quite 100%, and it went downhill from there. And with just 90 minutes before airtime at 7:30 Monday morning, I let our senior producer, Matt D'Angelo-Antonio, know I can't physically host today. There's no way. And Austin Cross came in and saved the day. He not only got to the station and did a great 2 hours of programming with very little time to prepare, but did his just usual stellar job, as he does, of course, every Friday or hosting when I'm away on vacation. But that's a terrible position to put a host in, to have to, with just minutes to go, do a two-hour program with no prep time. But that's how good Austin is, and so great that our production team, which is a heavy lift for them, pulled that off. But I'm particularly glad to be back with you, feeling so much better today after being out ill for the past couple of days. We have a jam-packed program, including three segments that are devoted to aspects of social media. We've got a new book out on what happened with the sale of Twitter between Jack Dorsey and the board of Twitter and Elon Musk and the rebranding as X and all of that. And we begin today's program with a look at this morning's rather one-sided vote by the House of Representatives. You just heard about it on NPR's Hourly News. The House passing a bill that would lead to a nationwide ban of the popular short video app TikTok. The condition would be that either ByteDance, which is the Chinese-owned parent company of TikTok, sells off the platform to an American ownership, or that it would be banned from the app stores of the major mobile phone platforms. The claim is that it's a national security threat, that when push came to shove, that ByteDance, the owner of TikTok, would have to turn over private information about its American users to the Chinese government, and that there would really be no way around that, despite the assurances that ByteDance makes that it is keeping all that information under its own control. Joining us to talk about the issues that are raised, because this is a highly complicated one, is Alex Barinka, who's tech reporter at Bloomberg. Alex, thank you for joining us.
Of course. Thanks for having me. Busy day for TikTok.
Boy, it is. So what sort of pushed the House into taking this action? This has been talked about. It's been contemplated. It's been floated. What led to this bipartisan move this morning?
Sure. And this is not the first bill that TikTok has actually faced in the U.S. House of Representatives, but it is the one that's gone the furthest with this vote this morning to pass it in the House. There is kind of a history here with TikTok where lawmakers are concerned about a few things. As you mentioned, TikTok's owned by ByteDance, a Chinese parent company. And in China, the Chinese government can request any kind of data from companies who are domiciled there. And that's raised some concerns that have not been, put to bed by TikTok's efforts to kind of cordon off and work with Oracle, an American tech company, to protect Americans' data. So you have that element where folks are worried about data collection. They're also worried about potential influence of Americans' feeds by the Chinese government through propaganda efforts or pushing on the lever of TikTok's powerful algorithm. And I think the last bucket that we've seen lawmakers incredibly kind of concerned about is this geopolitical fight with China. There is a broader umbrella here that TikTok has found itself under when it comes to some of the, some call it techno-nationalism, some call it just protecting our technology, that's created some kind of bad blood between Americans and China when it comes to the tech sector.
I was also wondering, Alex, when you had, and I can't recall if it was with the previous bill, but earlier, TikTok targeted by location its users who were within the districts of members of the committee considering the bill, asking them, and I think giving them the phone number of the representatives' offices to call and to protest a possible ban on TikTok, which, aside from ticking off the House members, would seem to sort of illuminate the very concern expressed that TikTok could marshal its users in a way to influence government.
Sure, certainly. And this kind of illuminates kind of the interesting disconnect, where a lot of users did see that as a charge for the democratic process that we know so well here in America. But lawmakers saw that as, you know, a fear that TikTok could influence the 170 million users that log into the app every month. What it also certainly did is prompt some Congress people to, you know, use that as a talking point on the steps of Capitol Hill to say, hey, look, this is how powerful this app is, that it can actually get people to pick up their phones and call us in ways that we haven't heard in a very long time.
Where does TikTok sit in its usage versus other social media platforms like Instagram?
By some measures, people spend as many as 90 minutes on average a day on the app, which is nearly double of some of Meta's platforms like Facebook and Instagram. So it's an app that certainly is one that people are spending a lot of time both scrolling on and now with TikTok Shop, opening their pocketbooks and shopping on. So when you combine those two factors, that there are 170 million people in the U.S., more than a billion worldwide who are on the app, and the fact that people are spending so much time because their algorithm is so sophisticated, it curates a feed that's both diverse and personalized, and that's kept people scrolling. It's become, you know, depending on who you ask, either a delightful place to scroll videos or a potential tool for influencing the minds of Americans or kind of running astray of national security concerns.
We're talking with Bloomberg tech reporter Alex Barinka. Next hour on Air Talk, we're going to discuss another issue involving TikTok, which is the impasse between Universal Music, which is the largest record label in the United States, its artists removed from TikTok because of a compensation dispute. We'll talk about that next hour. But right now, we're talking about the potential of Congress, and if President Biden were to sign such a bill, the banning of TikTok within the United States, unless it was sold to American ownership. Alex, what sort of reception will this bill likely get in the Senate?
That might be a little bit colder than what we saw in the House. In the House this morning, we saw a vote of 352 to 65, so overwhelmingly in favor of passing this. But Majority Leader Chuck Schumer in the Senate has so far declined to endorse it. And we've heard from members, including folks in the Republican camp, like Rand Paul, who have come out against it. So we know that TikTok CEO is on the ground as we speak in Washington, D.C. Their team, their lobbyists are focusing their efforts on the Senate, because as we've seen in the past, the Senate has been a place where a lot of House bills have gone to die. So a lot of their efforts will be focused on kind of swaying the thoughts and minds of folks in that chamber with the hope that this bill doesn't go any further.
Now, if this, let's say this went all the way through, hypothetically, President Biden signs it, would people still be able to sideload the app, or there's still other ways that they could use TikTok even with a formal ban?
Now, if that happens, it would be pretty unprecedented. We haven't really had that happen with an American consumer app. The way that we are hearing and experts are saying it would happen now is U.S. app stores, like those run by Apple or Google, would be prohibited from hosting the app, as well as internet service providers. So if you can download it somewhere other than Apple and Google, or if you have a VPN, which basically allows you to connect to the internet and convinces the internet you're in a place that's not American, America. There could be some side doors around it. But, you know, really generally speaking, I am a tech reporter. I know these things. I think there's an open question of how, you know, how technical people want to get in order to access these apps. Or do they go somewhere like Instagram? Do they go somewhere like Snap? Or does another homegrown technology company decide to kind of create another duplicate of TikTok?
Alex, before I let you go, one of the things I thought was kind of funny here was that President Biden said he would sign the bill if it got to his desk, but the Biden campaign has just gone on TikTok, which seemed kind of funny.
They have more than three dozen videos now. They're really leaning into kind of the internet speak and meme culture. So it seems like they see the value. Democrats in particular have been really, it's been really important for them to sway young voters. Young voters have come in handy for Biden both in his presidential election and in the last midterms to kind of stop that prophesized red wave that we were all talking about at the time. So he is certainly there. He certainly seems like he sees the value, at least the campaign does, for the presidential election, of reaching these people online. But I think it's a perfect illustration of just kind of the push-pull and the disconnect that you see between lawmakers and users who say, look, all these tech companies already have our data. We love the app. You should let it stay.
Alex, thank you so much for being with us and sharing what's going on with this legislation, which passed in a rather overwhelming 352-65 vote in the House this morning. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Alex Barinka, tech reporter at Bloomberg, to talk with us about the First Amendment versus national security issues this raises is Santa Clara University School of Law professor Eric Goldman. He co-directs the High Tech Law Institute at Santa Clara Law. Professor, good to have you with us. We appreciate it so much. So the First Amendment arguments would seem to be pretty straightforward here, that this would be governmental action that would be infringing speech. But are there examples where that speech can be curtailed on behalf of national security?
Thanks for having me this morning. I'm glad to hear that you're feeling better.
Thank you.
You say that the speech interests are straightforward, and I agree. But actually, there's three different speech interests at play, and I think it's worth breaking them apart so that people see just how much a ban would impact speech. There's the speech interests of TikTok as an app publisher and as a curator of speech. There's the speech interest of the users who are speaking to each other on TikTok. And then the third interest is the speech interest of the app stores themselves, which is also regulated by the bill. And so in order for us to appreciate the speech impact of the move, we have to think about all three of those categories of speech and the potential impact. Now, national security is often invoked as a basis for passing laws, including ones that might impact speech. But we have to really dig into what national security interests are at play, which we cannot do because that information is not public. So it's a little hard for us to put that balance together because we have these secret information about the national security interests. We don't know what those are in the public. And then we have a lot of speech interests to consider, three different categories.
So let me take a hypothetical. Let's say that ByteDance, the owner of TikTok, was hosting messages essentially from parties on behalf of the Chinese government calling for the overthrow of the U.S. government. Let's say something, it's as extreme as that. Would the U.S. government have a right to shut that down?
The short answer may be no, and that's because, in general, the First Amendment applies to all speakers, including those who have political viewpoints that are in opposition to our interests as a country. I will note that your example isn't hypothetical at all. Governments across the globe are posting messages on social media to promote their viewpoints and tweak their rivals. Sometimes they're doing it visibly in attributing it to themselves. Other times they're doing it surreptitiously. So whether or not we were to prevent the Chinese Communist Party from having a direct access to TikTok to post its message, that's going to take place across all social media, not just TikTok.
All right. And What about, for example, under FCC rules, if I'm not mistaken, foreign ownership of American TV stations is not allowed. And I thought the rationale for that was that there could be security concerns about foreign ownership of U.S. over-the-air television stations. Is there anything applicable from that?
Yeah, it's a great point. We do have areas where we restrict the ownership of certain assets in the United States, including in the speech arena, as you gave, with broadcasters. There are restrictions on the ownership of broadcasters. We had a Supreme Court case in 1997 that said that the rules applicable to broadcasting, including the potential for speech restrictions in the broadcasting arena, do not apply to the internet. The internet is not like broadcasting. Even if TikTok is primarily publishing video and TV stations that are subject to this foreign ownership regulation are publishing videos, the court said that they're not the same thing and they cannot be treated the same thing as from a regulatory standpoint. So the fact that there are restrictions on ownership for broadcasters doesn't answer any question about whether or not there could be restrictions on foreign ownership of websites.
We're talking with Santa Clara University Law School professor Eric Goldman. He co-directs Santa Clara Law's High Tech Law Institute. Eric, what about then the different forms of legal challenges if this were to run the full gauntlet, got Senate passage, president signed it, then on what sorts of grounds would you expect lawsuits and from whom?
So that's actually, again, not a hypothetical question because both the federal and state governments have tried to ban TikTok before. So bans on TikTok have already been in the court system and they've been struck down on a wide range of legal theories. Now, with respect to a federal ban as opposed to a state ban, the grounds of opposition might be narrower. There's some things states can't do that the federal government can do. But the primary challenge would be based on the First Amendment, that any ban on TikTok would infringe speech. And I mentioned the three different speech interests. The speech interests of TikTok as the publisher and curator speech, the interests of TikTok users, and the interests of the app stores. And each of those independently could bring a challenge, or they could coordinate. And each of those would have, I think, serious grounds to show that the ban is affecting their speech.
Professor, thank you so much for talking with us about the complexities that are at play here with the bill that was passed this morning by the House. Thank you, as always, for your time. We appreciate it.
Yeah. My pleasure. Thank you.
Eric Goldman, professor at Santa Clara University School of Law, co-director of their High Tech Law Institute. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Coming up, we'll talk about a pilot program that would pay, or actually is paying, I should say, students to attend community college. It's focusing on students who come out of a variety of difficult circumstances, having been incarcerated, having come out of the foster care system, and then attending college for the first time at community college. We'll talk about how much the students are getting and what the intent of the program is when we come back in just 1 minute.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. The state of California has allocated $30 million to a new program called Higher Up. It would pay some students by the hour minimum wage to attend community colleges. 10 colleges are participating. Some have already started, like Santa Rosa Junior College. Others are getting their programs ready to be up and running. Joining us from CalMatters, Community Colleges reporter Adam Eckelman. Adam, so good to have you with us this morning. So give us a bit more details about the students who are specifically targeted with the funding.
Yeah, so the program, as you said, it's called Hire Up, and the program is focused on three different populations. The first are people who are formerly incarcerated. The second is students who are former foster youth. And the last are people who receive CalWORKs benefits, which is the state's kind of cash aid program that's for folks with kids.
All right.
Those three different populations, they are all eligible for this money. And it's kind of like a guaranteed income program or like a universal basic income program, if you've heard about that. They are going to get paid a pretty standard amount every month. That amount can range, but you know, I talked to one student who's going to be receiving about $2,000 a month.
And which is, I think, more than the most of the universal basic income projects that have been done. And this is based on the idea of the minimum wage to attend school.
Yeah, and to your earlier point, Larry, that's totally true. So LA County is doing a guaranteed income program right now. It's giving people $1,000 a month. And interestingly, it's also focusing on people who are coming out of the foster youth system. So there's some similarities, but this, as I said, can be a lot more. I mean, some students who participate in this program could receive as much as $10,000 or more every semester.
Now, most community colleges do work. That's how they afford to put themselves through school, just given the demographics of who attends community college. So, what's the rationale for taking a particular subset of community college students and giving them this premium because they're presumably going to be working as well, like most community college students? What's the rationale for giving them additional help?
There's a long debate a bit among community college leaders about whether it's even good to work. A lot of community college students work. You're totally right. Most community college students are part-time, but a lot of experts say that's time that could be spent focusing on school. And a lot of folks say, you know, if we gave students more money so that they didn't have to work, they could graduate earlier and, you know, get back into the workplace. The dropout rate is really, really high at community college. And one of the reasons that people point to is that it takes a really long time to do a full-time job and get your associate degree, you know, go through community college. So the idea of this program is let's give students a little bit more money so that they can focus on school, graduate early. This is focusing on a pretty small subset. I mean, LA County, or the LA Community College District, I should say, has nine colleges. Those colleges have more than 150,000 students. This is the largest community college district in the country, some say the world. There's a lot of people here, and this is going to benefit maybe a few thousand students. So you're right, it's really small, relatively, but yeah, the logic that I've heard from the state's chancellor's office, you know, basically you've got to pick someone. They don't have enough money to give this to everybody. There are lots of other financial aid reforms that the chancellor's office is advocating for, but those are subject to the state legislature, and there's a lot of other things going on. So this is kind of a small scale pilot that's trying to solve this problem, giving students more money so they can hopefully graduate earlier.
I'd love to hear from listeners what you think about this program. A total of $30 million that's advocated for three particular target groups of community college students to give them this financial assistance, which is around $2,000 a month based on the minimum wage, paying them to go to community college. We're at 866-893-5722. Michael in Orange County emailed, "This is the ultimate example of a nanny state. Who came up with this kind of program and who gets the lottery win on this kind of deal? Given the state's budget shortfalls, this kind of program should really not have been put in place." We're at 866-893-5722. 5722. Of course, one of the things with this targeted group, you know, many community colleges do live with family members. That's how they handle the high cost of housing, and they work while they go to school. That's not uncommon at community colleges as the way the students get their education. But if you're talking about students who have come from the foster care system, they don't necessarily have family members they're going to be living with. So their living expenses, they're not going to necessarily have access to that. Again, those who've been incarcerated may similarly not have access to family members who would necessarily be providing them with a place that they could live while they go to community college. So these are specifically targeted categories. 866-893-5722. Also with us is Rachel Kutcher, who's Director of Student Financial Services at Santa Rosa Junior College in Northern California. It's a school that actually has started with this program. Rachel, thank you for being with us today.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
How do you identify the students? Because I'm guessing you have more in your student population who qualify for this than you're able to fund. How do you determine who gets the funding?
Sure. So at Santa Rosa Junior College, we identified the three groups, which are formerly incarcerated, former foster youth, and students in our CalWORKS program. And we prioritized formerly incarcerated students because they do not have access to other programs that, say, our former foster youth and CalWORKS students have. So we are, all of those groups are invited to participate, but for this spring launch, we are concentrating specifically on formerly incarcerated students.
And I was going to say, what do you say those who might be critical that, and certainly Adam raised this point, there is a high dropout rate in community college, and the financial part of that certainly is a factor for many students, but there are also other factors that lead to a high dropout rate. Students who come and go, who maybe don't have the same degree of commitment that you would see at a California State University or UC, for example. So, you know, what do you say to those who say, well, really, community college attendance is not stable enough, consistently enough, to pick and choose which students you're going to fund, who then may just drop out later for other reasons?
Well, one of the largest reasons why students don't persist is lack of financial support. That is, we survey our students annually and ask them why they're leaving school, and that is the number one answer. So by providing additional financial support, it is our intention to remove those barriers so that students can remain in school and be successful, focus on their education, and not have to focus as much on splitting their time between work and school obligations. So we're really trying to make school the focus.
We're talking with Rachel Kutcher of Santa Rosa Junior College, Director of Student Financial Services. Also with us is Nicole Albo-Lopez, Vice Chancellor of Educational Programs for the LA Community College District. Nicole, thank you very much for being with us. Vice Chancellor, please share with us what your district is doing to ramp up for this.
So we've spent the last few months looking at our data and determining which students are eligible for the program. And we've also had to work with our financial aid partners across our nine colleges to ensure that we have all of our appropriate systems ready to go to be able to package these students. It's a very intensive program. We monitor the student enrollment on a monthly basis. And, you know, that incentive comes month to month based on their enrollment. So we've been spending a lot of time getting that ready, and we'll be rolling this out to our participants early April.
Christina in Rancho Cucamonga says, I think this is a wonderful program. There's so many young people struggling to stay in college while working, like my granddaughter. How can we get more information regarding the program? Nicole Albo-Lopez, how do people find out information? Did they just contact their local community college?
So within the Los Angeles district, our nine colleges each have offices for our formerly incarcerated students, our foster youth, and our main CalWORKS participants. So if an individual student falls into one of those categories, they would go to their local community college, contact that office and work with a counselor or a project lead to submit an application.
All right, let's talk with Lisa in Glendale. Good to have you with us. Lisa, your question, please.
Hi, Larry. Good morning. Good morning. Yeah, my question is, when a person qualifies to get this program, and maybe they happen to be living at the poverty line and are getting welfare, like getting food stamps or getting assistance through disability or different things like that, does this impact their eligibility and reduce their food stamps or, you know, a situation like that? I have different friends that are on government programs, and whenever they get any extra grant through some place, it seems to decrease their food stamps or help, you know, impact their Social Security or disability benefits.
Sure, the same way if they were getting that money for a job they were doing. Lisa, it's a great question you ask. Rachel Kutcher, do you know the answer to that?
This is a financial aid grant. It is not considered income, so it does not count against their income.
All right, very good. Lisa, excellent question. Thank you. George in Torrance, you're on Air Talk.
Hey, Carrie. Another hot button topic. My question is there any restrictions on the focus of their studies? Like, you know, are they being encouraged to focus on something in terms of STEM or to be a technician or some type of specialization that's actually going to help them with their upward mobility? Or are they going to do like creative writing with respect to ceramics or something like that?
Vice Chancellor Abel Lopez, can you answer that, please?
So there are no limitations on the program of study, but at the community college level, a large majority of our programs help our students move directly into the world of work and are transferred to a four-year institution. So in these particular categories, most of our students are working in our career and technical education programming.
All right, George, thank you so much. Don in Playa del Rey, to make this program work, I think the schools have to have strong candidates for the program, but schools also need a support system to make sure the funds are used correctly and the students are getting the support they need. Rachel Kutcher at Santa Rosa Junior College, are there supports for students who are coming from these backgrounds that can make getting through college even more challenging?
Absolutely. Participants in our program are connected through our Rising Scholars Network, which is a wraparound support program for formerly incarcerated students. We provide them with specialized counseling supports, academic supports, and emotional support. And that goes for our former foster youth and our CalWORKS programs. We have specific wraparound so that we are ensuring that they are successful.
Rachel, what happens when the funding runs out? Are the students going to be left high and dry?
That's a great question, because that is what we, in this pilot program, are looking specifically to make sure that we're spending all this money, that we have really great outcomes for our students through these wraparound supports, and we can demonstrate that this is a program that can be sustainable over time. So we're really hoping to show that there is a significant need and students are achieving the outcomes that the funds are intended to achieve.
I want to thank you all so much for describing this program. Again, the name of it is Higher Up, H-I-R-E-UP, a $30 million state program which is being tried at a number of community colleges. 10 schools are participating. Others will be starting in the fall, including the Los Angeles Community College District. Our thanks to Vice Chancellor Nicole Albo Lopez. Our thanks to Santa Rosa Junior College Administrator Rachel Kutcher, and our thanks to Adam Eckelman of CalMatters, who covers community colleges and wrote about this. That's how we learned about this program in the first place. You're listening to Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Coming up, the wonderful experience of being in a book club.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
the also potential hell of being in a book club, the pros and cons, what can go wrong, and what can be incredibly rewarding about getting together with others and talking about a particular book you've all read. I'd love to hear from you, the best and worst of book clubs. We're at 866-893-5722. We'll be back in 90 seconds.
This is LAist 89.3, serving Carson, Walnut, La Palma, Big Bear Lake, and the rest of Southern California.
The year is 2054, and a new technological weapon has killed the president. How a new novel imagines how America responds. That's next time on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 1 on LAist 89.3.
I'm Megan Garvey, LAist Executive Editor. Our spring fundraiser starts soon, but we're trying to do it in 5 days instead of 10. Cutting this member drive in half is a big risk. We can't cut back on our $1 million goal for powering the news and programming you depend on from LAist and NPR. The only way to get back to the news faster is by hearing from all the members in half the time, and that includes you. Think about how vital independent, trustworthy news is to our democracy, especially in this election year. At a time when journalists are losing jobs, the future of independent reporting is under threat. Help protect this important service for your entire community by supporting LAist today. Plus, your donation now will unlock a $100,000 challenge. All the members, half the time. Everyone wins, but it will take you to make it happen. Donate now at laist.com/give. Thank you.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Book clubs, beloved by undoubtedly millions of Americans. They're huge here in Southern California and have been for years. Of course, the history of book club goes back probably to the nation's founding. I would bet it shortly after the printing press, there were probably book clubs. But they've evolved over the years. Some of them have a professional who leads the conversation, chooses or helps the group choose the book that they're going to focus on. Others wing it, and they choose their own books. They don't necessarily have a designated leader for every month's meeting, but rotate it through the group. A whole different way of doing book clubs. But we're going to talk about a way that's particularly effective, and that is hiring someone to come in and lead the process. Julie Goler, our guest, is a book group facilitator based here in Los Angeles. Julie, thank you for being with us and talking about what you do. You have a great job.
I agree. So much fun.
So you have to have these obviously scheduled out so that if you're doing second Tuesday of the month with one group, you don't have another, but the other is first Wednesday.
Yeah. I don't cheat on my groups. You own that night.
So what role do you, how far do you go in determining what's read and the nature of the conversation on the book?
To a great extent, I read constantly, and then if I'm reading books in February, those books appear on my menu in March, and then the book groups will have an opportunity to choose from those books that I have on the menu in March, and they're kind of picking right now for May or June.
All right.
Yeah.
And so do you give them a sort of a short distillation of the different books to consider, and then they vote on that?
I do. I write a brief blurb, and then I have reviews that follow, and they get an option to choose the book or not choose the book. Sometimes I'll have a book in there that will be recreational, and I'll say for extra credit, you should read this on your own. And other times I'll write in the menu that this is an absolute, we must read this. This is a best book of the year according to these publications, and this moved me beyond measure.
The composition of groups are going to be so different. You might have one that's a highly intellectual group. They're really, you know, big, living in the world of ideas. Mm-hmm. You might have others that are, you know, working in a particular industry, so maybe more interested in books that are about, that have a business component. How do you take that into account and find the types of books for them to choose that are going to be a good fit?
I try to find books that I love. And that's really the criteria. Do I love them? Are they literary? Are they highly reviewed? Are they possibly book award winners or books that have gotten a lot of acclaim. And that's all I'm looking for.
Okay.
I'm not trying to target it to the group. So I will tell groups when I think this is a better fit for your group or not a better fit. A group with a lot of young mothers may not necessarily want to read a book that is 900 pages long. So I pay attention to that. But they ultimately get to choose. If book groups hire me, it's because they like the way I read.
We're talking with leader of book groups, Julie Goler. She's a book group facilitator based in Los Angeles. Again, I'd like to hear from you. If you have any cautionary stories about a book group that went wrong, because of course that can happen. Things can get very heated in our very polarized political world. People can storm off, friendships break up over books and the conversations around them. I'd love to hear if you have a cautionary tale and how you think it might have been avoided or how it was repaired. If there are particular challenges you had in a book group that were overcome, I'd love to hear about that. We're at 866-893-5722. Joining me is Allie in Altadena. Allie, thanks so much. Share with us about your book club and what leads you to be a part of it.
Hi. So we meet every other Tuesday to discuss our books, and then the Tuesdays we don't meet for books. It's just girls' night. But we have had some conflicts, and we've resolved them by basically saying nobody else is allowed to join the book club. We're maxed out at 12 women, which is quite a lot, as well as we choose our books based on a draft style, right? So we used to do it on a voting. We've done it on spin the wheel for the book, and that just leads to some people maybe getting hurt that their book wasn't chosen. This way, if we're doing the draft style, so I'll get to pick next week and kind of force everyone to read the book I've been wanting to read for X amount of months. And that's worked out actually pretty well for us because it makes it a better just group of books that we are reading, right? So we have so many different people. You know, we have a baker, we have a PhD student at Caltech, and they're going to choose maybe different type of book for us all to read, and it just really expands the horizons more.
Yeah, in my mother's book group, Allie, they vote. So people, you know, they nominate a book and then they vote for which one out of the nominees that the members of the club vote for. But yours is interesting how they go about that process. Does that sort of avoid hurt feelings?
It has, definitely. And also just frustrations. I can speak for myself. I was frustrated because when we were nominating books, it was always a fantasy book getting picked, and I'm not a big fantasy reader.
Yeah.
So it just kind of felt tiredness and not as expanding my horizons. So I'm very happy with the new way we're doing it, sort of this draft style. And it's just, you know, expanding our reading what we're comfortable with as well, too, this way.
You said your club is all women, I believe. Do you think it would be a change the dynamic if there was a man or were men in the group?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I do know another friend. She is in a group with, you know, people of the opposite gender and or non-binary. And I think she gets different things out of that book club than she gets from our normal book, or not normal, rather, but
but all women, yeah.
She just, yes.
Allie, thank you so much. Allie in Altadena, we're at 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. You can also go to the AirTalk page at las.com/airtalk, and you'll see the window there where you can enter your comment about your book club there, or you can email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. So, Julie, you hear there all the different ways the groups go about choosing a book, and if you got widely divergent tastes, that can be challenging.
Right. excuse me. I think it's helpful at the formation of a book group to talk about the types of books that you would like to read, and then to agree on that. Even if you're 2 years into a book group and you think that it's not really working for whatever reason, to take a moment and set standards. This is the kind of book that we want to read. We always want to read literary fiction, or we'd like to read mostly literary fiction with one memoir a year and maybe one historical fiction. Just decide what you're going to do so that there is a plan, and then go for it.
Makes a lot of sense. 866-893-5722. Bon in Laguna Niguel says, I initiated a book club. It was a big club already, and then people kept bringing in more people. I eventually left because it was too hard to handle so many people. Book club should state rules, just as you were saying, Julie, like how many people can join before things go wrong.
We don't add any members to my groups until people drop. And if people drop for whatever reason, people will put out a member and talk about their reading styles and their reading taste and why this person would be a good fit for the group. And members don't, it's not really a vote thing, but we talk about whether it's a good fit and they join or they don't.
Is there an ideal number for a group?
Yeah, I would say between 12 and 15. And the reason for that is you don't get every member at any time. So what I'm shooting for is 10 to 12 people to show up.
And what's the etiquette in terms of if you're really not into a book, is it okay to take a month off?
I recommend not taking a month off. I say that the commitment to the group is to the group, not to the book. And so often I'll tell people if you've had a rough month, if it's you couldn't get into it, you might have had a loss, please come to the book group anyway. We care about you more than anything else. But the content of our discussion will be the book.
Okay. Which can be interesting even if you haven't had a chance to
100%.
Read it. You just don't want to be the person who every month you haven't read the book, obviously.
Those people don't tend to stay around.
I can imagine. All right. We're at 866-893-5722. Book club's our topic. We've got some listeners who've already joined us. We'll talk with them when we come back in 1 minute. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us as we talk book clubs with Julie Gohler, who's a book group facilitator based in Los Angeles. So she's a pro. She's paid. She comes in and she's there every month with her club. She works with a wide range of them and helps them with the process of choosing the book. She leads the conversation. And then it avoids a lot of the pitfalls that some of the less formal book clubs can have. What's the range of compensation that people get for leading book clubs?
Oh, gosh. The range could be anywhere. Like if you hire a PhD grad student, I don't really know.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a unique skill set, and it should be well compensated.
Yeah, I was trying to remember. Fees Revs reading in the LA Times an article from a few. Now this goes back a few years,
mm-hmm.
pre-inflation, $300 to $500 for a 90-minute session. I assume it's higher now.
Oh,
so
yeah.
That gives an idea. 866-893-5722. Elizabeth in West Hollywood. So good to have you with us. Share your book club experience, please.
Well, I've been a member of this club. I'm a new member, and I've been a member for 20 years. The book club's been around for about 30 years. They're mostly women in the arts. Many women are former professors. A lot are retired now. And we have a leader every month, and we have a host, and we rotate. And we only read literary fiction. And these women are so important in my life. And I'm important to them. We care for each other. We look out for each other. And during COVID, we met on Zoom. And it's really a high point of my life. And then there's always the food and the discussions, which are fantastic.
Elizabeth, so with the literary fiction that's the focus of your group, I don't know if you can put this into words, but talking about the themes of those books, how does that make the women in the group closer, or how does that help reveal things about yourself to others in the group?
Well, parts of the discussion are revelatory because we have women who went to school at Oxford and were preyed upon and groomed by professors and didn't even realize it till we were in a discussion 50 years later. We have women who've had spectacular careers and have had sick children. And of course, literature is universal, and it tells the story of our lives through the lives of others. And that is something that's been very, very, very instrumental and formative for all of us. I think I can speak for all of us when I say that.
Elizabeth, it sounds great that this intellectual stimulation, but also the emotional connection that occurs between the members of the group. Thank you. Beautiful call. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. Julie, I mean, she said it so
she
well.
She says it. She spoke the truth. One of my favorite stories from my book groups is a woman was going through treatment for cancer, and she also happened to have been diagnosed right before a major move, and we kept asking her what we could do to help, what do you need, and she said honestly to me, you know, what would really help me is if the women would show up and help me pack up for one day. I'll have pizza, but I could really use the help right now, and that's what we do. We're there for each other. It's a really beautiful thing.
We're at 866-893-5722, or you can email us at atcomments@las.com. Ted at LAX, we're tight on time, but please quickly share your experience with book clubs.
Hi, Larry. It's Ted. I run Live Talks LA, and a lot of book groups use the videos from our events, which is great. But me personally, my gauge of book clubs is two things. One, how good are the bakers in the group? And two, how good is the wine?
All right. Dad, I appreciate it. Thanks very much. Who has a wonderful speaker series. And some book clubs, I know, bring in the authors.
I do that quite frequently. Yeah. About 40% of the time, I'll bring in the author.
Yeah. My mother's book club does that. They'll reach out and often be able to get the author to come speak to the group. Sherry in Mission Viejo, good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be there.
Go right ahead.
Okay, so there is 10 of us that we formed this book club. We're all friends. We try to meet every 6 weeks. We each host the next book club. So the host gets to choose which book to read for the next session. And we try to do different types of books, different topics, from social to economy to... Yeah. Love stories to fiction, nonfiction. So there's a variety of different books that we choose to, you know, to read.
So but some months it's probably,
so yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, some months it probably doesn't connect with the majority of the group necessarily if you're ranging that wide in the things you choose.
Right. Well, it becomes very interesting because then we have everybody's different opinions about, you know, about the book. Some of us agree, some of us don't agree. But it's a very good discussion. And the nice thing is that we discuss the book for a length of time. And then after that, it really turns into a lot of other topics that we talk about and we share, opinions, we share experiences. And, of course, we have good food and good wine, and which is always, you know, a nice thing to have.
Makes a convivial experience. Sherry, thanks so much. I'm sorry we're out of time. But in your groups, too, Julie, don't you have conversation after you do the formal discussion of the book?
We go in the other direction. They'll have dinner first, and at 7:45 we launch into discussion immediately. So there's a place for both things.
All right, very good. Thank you so much for joining
us,
Julie.
Thanks for having me.
I'm sure there'll be people contacting you about this, whether your plate is full with book clubs or not. Julie Goler, thank you so much. Book group facilitator based in Los Angeles. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Much more to come in our second hour.
Flash flood warnings across Coachella Valley.
The journalists of LAist work for you.
I'm Erin Stone, the climate emergency reporter at LAist.
Desalination really should be considered as a last resort.
I bring you the information and connections you need to understand, cope with, and prepare for the changes caused by the climate emergency.
Potential for what's called land spouts, which are basically like mini tornadoes.
LAist, independent journalism, fact-based journalism.
The new book, Battle for the Bird, Jack Dorsey, Elon Musk, and the $44 billion fight for Twitter's soul, We'll talk with the author of the book, tech writer Kurt Wagner. That's coming up later on Air Talk. But we turn our attention right now to COVID-19 and a new study which indicates that the virus can persist in the blood and tissue of patients for more than a year after they have dealt with acute COVID-19. Joining us to talk about it from UC San Francisco School of Medicine, where he's infectious disease researcher and the lead person on this new study, Dr. Michael Peluso. Dr. Peluso, thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So share with us what blood and tissue samples you studied for this. Were these collected from people when they had COVID?
Our program in San Francisco collects samples from people after they've had COVID. And so this study was looking in both the blood compartment and the tissue compartment of people who had COVID as far back as 2020. For up to 14 months after their initial infection.
And so to what extent did you find COVID still there?
Yeah, so, you know, the framework that we have for COVID is that it should be transient in most people. It should come and go. But what we found in blood was that about 10% of people between 3 months and 14 months after they had COVID had remnants of this virus floating around in their bloodstream. The people who were more likely to have that were people who had been sick enough to be hospitalized with COVID, or people who just felt that they were very, very sick during their acute infection. But it was quite a striking finding because it really goes against the framework that we've held for so long about how this virus should act.
And does it have any sort of relationship with long COVID symptoms?
Well, that's probably now the most important question. We're currently seeing this in people with long COVID, as well as some people who don't have any long COVID symptoms, but that doesn't mean that there aren't long-term consequences. We know that after a person has a COVID infection, they're at higher risk for a variety of different medical complications. And so most of our focus over the next year is going to be trying to figure out, you know, whether this actually has a downstream biologic effect and increases people's risk of long COVID or risk of other medical events after COVID. It's just too soon to know.
In this 10% with evidence of COVID in the blood or tissue 3 to 14 months afterwards, is there any way to determine if the immune system is still attempting to respond to those remnants of COVID-19 or not?
That's a great question. So that's something that we're looking at in our tissue study. So what we do in that study is we do flexible sigmoidoscopies, sort of like mini colonoscopies, to get rectal tissue. And we can look at where the remnants of the virus are located and what the immune cells are doing around that area. And what we're seeing is that there are immune cell infiltrates around the area where we're seeing the pieces of the virus. And so what we think is that either this virus is being walled off by the immune system or the immune system is responding in some way. And so what we're focusing on now is figuring out exactly what those cells are and what they're doing. It's equally possible right now that this virus is just inert and isn't causing harm, but that's what really the next question to figure out is going to be.
And Dr. Peluso, is this atypical for viruses like COVID-19 to be lingering so long in the system?
So there are some viruses, things like HIV and herpes viruses, the virus that causes chickenpox, that we know basically stick around forever in people. The class of viruses that COVID is from, coronaviruses, are not typically thought to stick around. But if you actually look back at a lot of careful research that's been done over the last 20 or 30 years, there is a precedent for this type of virus sticking around in some people. And we've never really done a deep dive into why that is and what the effects are. And so with long COVID and you know, with COVID, so many people being affected, we really have our first chance to figure this out, to answer this question for not only this virus, but also other viruses that have the potential to cause long-term consequences.
And do we know if there's enough in these remnants that they could flare up and cause a person to get acutely sick again from COVID-19?
There is currently no evidence to suggest that that is what is going on. Right now, we think that these are pieces of the virus that are likely not to be actively replicating, but it's possible that, you know, they still should not be there and can be causing an adverse, you know, a bad immune response. And so that is, that's sort of where we're at with this research right now.
Dr. Peluso, thank you very much for being with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Dr. Michael Peluso, infectious disease researcher at the UC San Francisco School of Medicine, who led this new study taking a look at the blood and tissue samples of people who've had COVID-19 and finding in about 10% of those blood samples anywhere from 3 to 14 months after the acute infection and the obvious symptoms that there were still remnants of COVID-19 present. Also joining us, a colleague of Dr. Peluso's, Dr. Peter Chin Hong, you know him so well, infectious disease specialist at UC San Francisco Medical Center, where he's professor of medicine. Dr. Chin Hong, so good to have you back. Welcome.
Morning, Larry. Thanks for having me on.
So your thoughts about the significance of this study done at your same research facility?
Well, I think the significance is really whether or not we could attenuate or make the symptoms better in people who have long COVID now, because if there is persistent virus for that long as 14 months, and people have symptoms, like you asked, could it be that we need to give them antivirals now, or is being studied by some folks, monoclonal antibodies to kind of mop up some of that extra virus that's hiding out? And could that make people feel better? Right now, the theory is that there may be two reasons why people have these chronic symptoms. The first is persistent virus, like Dr. Peluso talked about. But the other could be an overactive immune system. So whether or not some people have more of one over the other, and we can therefore design therapies that can make people feel better.
And you mean overactive immune system in terms of the long COVID symptoms?
Yes. So your immune system gets angry after it gets exposed to the virus. If the virus is still present, the immune system continues to be active, cause inflammation, and the inflammation can cause the symptoms in the various organs that people have. So by targeting either the virus or the inflammation, you can make people feel better. But maybe some people have more virus and some people might have more inflammation and less virus. So your therapy might have to be modified based on how that person presents with long COVID.
It still sounds like the big challenge here is to determine whether this 10% of patients who still have COVID-19 in some remnant form in their bodies, if that coincides with the incidence of long COVID. Because if it's essentially benign, if it's there but not really having an effect, then does it matter?
Yeah, it may not matter in some people. And, you know, I think one of the big questions, too, is a very basic one, is how can you use a test to diagnose someone with long COVID? Right now, we use a constellation of clinical findings, but they're very nonspecific. And perhaps if you can have that test, and part of the reason why you might not know if that persistent virus is associated with long COVID is because we don't really have a great test for long COVID yet, apart from clinical criterion. So you're right. It may end up being an innocent bystander in some, like, chickenpox virus or other herpes viruses that remain dormant and may not cause symptoms in people for the rest of their lives.
Dr. Peter Chin Hong, UC San Francisco Medical Center, joining us, infectious disease specialist. Dr. Chin Hong, are we seeing people who've been dealing over the past few years with long COVID finally recovering from those symptoms? And if so, is there any commonality in what's causing the recovery?
Yes, so we do see people recover. It's not a uniform length of time that people have symptoms. For example, many people will recover within a year. It's still a long period of time, still causes a lot of problems with life and relationships and work and school. But the most recent study, the federal study called the Household Pulse Study, looked at us people in America how many of you ever had long COVID? And it was 18%. It's quite a large number, millions of people. But then they asked them, how many of you still have symptoms with long COVID? And it's about 6.8%. So even from that most recent survey, you know, it kind of gives a number to the people who continue to have persistent symptoms.
And that would appear to be going down considerably then, right? 6.8%?
Yes, it's going down for a few reasons. The first is that people who had symptoms early on in the pandemic kind of go through their natural history and may have recovered within a year. The second reason is that, you know, of course, we have vaccines now and early therapies that might lower the chance of getting long COVID. And the third is, of course, the variants that we're seeing now are probably less likely to cause long COVID than the earlier variants like Alpha and Delta.
Because we do see an association, don't we, between the severity of the acute COVID illness and the likelihood someone's going to have long COVID symptoms?
Yes. We also know that people who go to the ICU, for example, and that was more common early on in the pandemic compared to now, they have a higher chance of getting long COVID symptoms. We know that even people in the outpatient setting who have more serious disease, they have a higher chance of getting long COVID, even if they don't go to the hospital. And that's actually borne out by Dr. Peluso's work too, where there was a relationship with how sick you are, between how sick you are and what the probability of getting persistent virus detected in either your bloodstream or in tissue was, you know, up to 14 months later.
Dr. Peter Chin Hong with us on Air Talk. I also wonder, you know, we're 4 years out from the World Health Organization declaring COVID-19 to be at pandemic level. Monday was that four-year anniversary. What have we learned about the ability of hospitals and emergency rooms to be able to respond to mass illness like this? Because they were clearly overwhelmed, and this has to raise, you know, concerns about future highly contagious and even more lethal illnesses. And I say that in full knowledge of all the people that died from COVID-19, but there certainly could be more lethal illnesses coming. Are we prepared for those, better prepared?
I'm not sure we're better prepared, but we are somewhat prepared. I'd probably give it a B or a C grade in terms of a future pandemic, unfortunately. But what we did learn was that hospitals can definitely transform, but there are consequences for later, you know, control of cancer and other chronic diseases, that politics plays a big role. And you know, I like the term that David Leonhardt in New York Times recently called red COVID, which is really the way that different states or counties embrace vaccines. And therefore, that affected the people going to the hospital who were sick, because 95% of the people in the hospital right now have not had a recent booster. And of course, we learned about disparities There are structural inequalities that prevent people from even getting access to the hospital. So I think these are some of the messages that we've learned, and we really have to internalize that for the next pandemic, which will come for sure.
Yeah, and so as an infectious disease professional, seeing what we went through in COVID, and you're preparing your whole career for the potential of something like this, does it concern you all the more seeing how something like COVID-19 could tie us in knots the way it did, knowing that there could well be more lethal viruses down the road?
Yes, it does give me a lot of room for pause. I do look at the epidemic within the pandemic, which was mpox, as a sort of dress rehearsal for another, a situation that might occur. And we did pretty well with mpox because we learned the lessons from COVID in terms of transformation and distribution and messaging that implemented, you know, our strategies really well. But again, mpox was really hard hit in, three of the most liberal cities, New York, LA, and San Francisco, where, you know, that alignment between politics and the health system and public health was already there. So I think at the minimum, those are some of the lessons that we need to take to the future, which is about, you know, having a singular message that's trusted by the people, by sharing data, by having a robust infrastructure and stockpiling certain medicines, you know, but corporations sharing data and diagnostics and vaccines. These are all things that, you know, I think we need to take to the future.
All right. Well, much left for us to talk about in a future conversation, and that is the potential of mRNA vaccines now that we've seen the tremendous success with those for COVID-19 and what sorts of other vaccines are in or could be in development. We'll talk about that in the future. Thank you so much, Dr. Chin Hong. Always a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks so much, Larry.
Dr. Peter Chin Hong, UC San Francisco Medical Center, where he's professor of medicine. He's an infectious disease specialist and one of our COVID-19 experts who for years was with us regularly providing invaluable information on COVID-19, on vaccines, and on treatment for COVID. So great to have him a part of our LAist Air Talk family. Coming up, we're going to be turning our attention to Twitter. We'll talk about its evolution as a company and also the sale, of course, to Elon Musk. But coming up next, we'll talk about TikTok and Universal Music in its dispute with TikTok, meaning that Universal's artists have been pulled off the platform, a platform that is very reliant on pop music. And Universal's the biggest producer of pop music in America. We'll hear more when we come back in just 1 minute. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Coming up at 11 o'clock, it's NPR's Here and Now. They'll have the latest on the passage this morning of the bill, which, if it goes through the Senate and reaches the president's desk and is signed, would ban the TikTok app from people's phones in the United States because of concerns about the Chinese-owned company's control and potential for U.S. data end up in the hands of the Chinese government. We're going to turn our attention now to TikTok, which, of course, is a short video platform, and its reliance on pop music from artists who are under contract to Universal Music, which is the biggest of the music companies, or even songwriters who even can be co-writers of music but have some ancillary relationship with Universal Music and therefore have the songs pulled off of the platform. Joining us to talk about the dispute is Ari Herstand, who's columnist with Variety, a musician himself, and author of How to Make It in the New Music Business. Ari, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
So first of all, give us a sense of the size of Universal Music Group and how much music this has made unavailable to users of TikTok.
Sure. Like you said, this not only affects the artists that are signed to Universal Music Group record companies and the labels, but it also is affecting many other artists not associated with Universal Music Group and the record companies, because these artists, often many of them independent artists, may have co-written a song with a songwriter that is signed as a songwriter to Universal Music Publishing Group. It's estimated that around 7 million songs have now been taken down or muted from TikTok, and they no longer appear in these videos.
Presumably, this isn't going to have a huge effect on the mega stars, the household names, Beyonce and Taylor Swift and the like. But who are the artists who are going to find this either diminishing their opportunity to grow audience or even having a negative financial impact?
Right, exactly. The global superstars are going to be completely fine. And what's most concerning here are these emerging independent artists, many of whom have found their success because of TikTok over the last few years. I mean, TikTok is the most powerful promotional platform for music over the past 5 years. And I would argue kind of in the history of the music industry, we haven't really seen careers jumpstart like they have over the last few years because of the reach and customization of TikTok. And so there's a lot of independent artists that I've spoken to directly that have seen immediate effects from this, where oftentimes their marketing and promotional strategies are halted in its tracks when they are releasing music right now. And they're unable to promote those songs, and it is actually affecting their bottom lines, and it is hurting their careers materially.
So if they're looking now at an alternative during this impasse period, looking at YouTube or I don't know what other platforms would be close to comparable, what are the limitations of those other platforms? What they can't do there that they had been able to do on TikTok?
Sure. Well, the closest comparison right now is Instagram Reels. And Instagram famously, of course, is you know, copied some of the features of its rival platforms, you know, TikTok being no exception. And it is their version of its own internal TikTok on Instagram, they're calling Reels. We've started to see some songs kind of connect on the platform similarly to how they connect on TikTok. However, it's by no means as effective, and artists will be the first to say that you know, the fans that they get from TikTok are the ones that actually go to streaming services, listen to their music, which those streaming services then pay for their music, and they're the ones that are buying tickets. And the data does show that TikTok does have a higher percentage of their audience that will support music financially by buying tickets, buying merchandise, streaming the music. And so Instagram Reels is the closest. YouTube also has Shorts, which similarly, you know, has seen a little bit of success recently in terms of kind of the promotional aspects, but nothing is close to what TikTok has shown for the general music community.
We're talking with Ari Hirstand, who is columnist with Variety and author of How to Make It in the New Music Business. Also with us from the University of Miami, director of the Music Industry Program, Sirona Elton, and she was, before moving into academe, the vice president of Warner Music Group. Sirona, thank you very much for being with us. What is Universal seeking in the way of additional compensation, and is any of that to go to artists or just to the conglomerate?
So we don't know exactly what Universal is asking. Those negotiations are confidential. Universal has raised the fact that they are unhappy about three particular pieces of their overall deal. One piece is the compensation that would come to Universal, but the other two have to do with the effects of artificial intelligence and online safety for the users. So we don't know exactly what it is that Universal's asking for and TikTok isn't giving them. But what I will say from a compensation perspective is the way that contracts work between recording artists and Universal Music on the recorded side, and between songwriters and Universal Music Publishing on the publishing side, is that whatever revenue Universal is receiving for the use of its music, they then have a royalty obligation. In other words, the obligation to pay a certain percentage of that money on to their recording artists and to their songwriters according to the terms of those deals. So presumably if Universal is getting paid more for the use of its music, that money will also translate into more money going to artists and songwriters.
So I would think that performers and songwriters would have real mixed feelings about this, the loss of the platform to boost their new product, but also, you know, would perhaps be cheering on parts of this because of additional compensation. Is that accurate?
Yes, I think it is. And I think the different perspectives, you know, can be influenced by the stage of the career that an artist is at. You know, as Ari was mentioning, TikTok is particularly viewed as a phenomenal tool to introduce new artists to their potential market. And new artists may also be a little bit younger in age and may not have been through sort of prior instances of this kind of thing happening in the music business with other platforms in the past. So, you know, I think the perspective of the creators is definitely likely to be influenced in terms of where they're at in their career, how reliant they are on TikTok as the primary driver of people to their music, and, you know, perhaps how long they've been doing this in the industry.
Now, you were an executive at Warner Music Group. Are the other labels, do you think, just sort of silently cheering Universal on with this?
Oh, well, I mean, who knows? You know, they have deals in place. They're not going to publicly comment, as, you know, some have reported, likely for antitrust reasons. And so, you know, who knows?
Okay.
I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if you know, a lot of other rights holders are, you know, watching this very, very closely, and, you know, are perhaps hoping that this all shakes out in a way that really benefits rights holders.
And does this have any implications, depending on how this is resolved one way or the other, for later negotiations with streaming services like Spotify?
Well, I actually think this will have less of an impact on negotiations with services like Spotify than it will with the next social media platform that pops up. You know, I think they're really, consumers just think they hear music all over the place, but we actually have to really separate out the Spotify's and the Apple Music's of the world, where you go there, you know, to stream music and you listen to the entire recording, or you have that option, which is very different than the way you interact with music on, you know, Facebook or Instagram or TikTok. Or YouTube in some ways, although YouTube has a number of different services that it offers. So I think here we're really talking about the way music is being used in a social media, social video context, which is a bit different than it is on pure audio services.
And with your students in your music industry program at the University of Miami, how much emphasis do you put on, I mean, they're growing up with social media, obviously, and they're heavy consumers, but how much emphasis do you put on being a content creator on social media as being part of building your popularity as a musician, a working musician?
Well, I think it's critically important. You know, there is some variation depending on the genre and the age of your likely music consumer. You know, popular music is very targeted at the youth, and the youth are on social media. You know, there are some other genres where if the intended market might skew a little bit older, it may play a slightly lesser role in the overall marketing mix. But absolutely, social media on the whole plays a critical role really in everybody's marketing campaign as a primary way to connect with your fans all over the world. So we definitely emphasize it, but not to the point of excluding everything else. There are a number of other ways you can connect with your fans as well.
We're talking with Sirona Elton, who is with the University of Miami. She directs the music industry program and was a VP of Warner Music Group. Also with us is Variety columnist Ari Herstand, author of How to Make It in the New Music Business. He's a musician himself. Ari, I did want to get into briefly the AI issue here. So what do we understand, if we understand anything, about the dispute between Universal Music Group and TikTok over use of AI?
Sure. You know, like Sirona was mentioning, these negotiations are pretty opaque. But from what Universal has mentioned, and from just kind of looking at the patents that ByteDance and TikTok have, you know, registered or applied for in the U.S., we can kind of assume what they're looking to do. And so, you know, they haven't really rolled out a massive kind of AI, generative AI music program within TikTok that we've seen that's been widely used. So we're not really sure exactly. Universal claims that TikTok is looking to kind of replace human artists with AI-generated music. However, it's worth noting that, you know, Universal, they've similarly struck deals with AI music companies recently, where I feel like they're kind of taking the approach that if you can't beat them, join them. And they have now they've struck these deals where they're going to start releasing AI-generated music either based on their catalog with no human involvement. So I feel like this is kind of a war of words between TikTok and Universal. It's really hard to gauge exactly where the negotiations are at, how much blustering is going on between these companies, and what is actually accurate.
Well, and AI is a huge part of the popular music business already, right?
Yeah, and that's true. And any songwriter or artist or producer that you will talk to currently uses AI tools for creation. And we've actually been using AI tools for many, many years, even if we didn't know it was AI. If something like correcting the pitch of a singer, that is a tool within many recording programs that you can use that uses AI technology, or creating a harmony within the recording. That's a tool that a producer could use. And those are AI tools, or even something within the songwriting rooms that I've seen in experiences, you could kind of ask an AI chatbot to kind of help you with an analogy, or maybe write a song in the style of Rihanna or something like that, that, you know, they're not going to use exactly as the AI chatbot or the AI program sends it out to them, but they will use it as inspiration. And so, similar to how songwriters have used, you know, a rhyming dictionary to help them with rhymes, songwriters, producers, and artists are using AI tools as just that, as tools to help them with their productions.
Get you past that block. Ari, thank you so much. Really appreciate your joining us today and talking about the ongoing dispute between Universal Music Group and TikTok. Thank you.
Thank you.
Columnist with Variety and Sirona Elton of the University of Miami, where she directs their music industry program. Sirona, thank you so much. We really appreciate your being with us as well.
Thank you.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Coming up, we talk about the tumultuous change of ownership in Twitter, now known as X. We'll talk with Kurt Wagner, who is a business and technology journalist for Bloomberg. His new book is Battle for the Bird, Jack Dorsey, Elon Musk, and the $44 billion fight for Twitter's soul. We'll be back in just 90 seconds.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of the How to LA podcast. How about we go to the movies? Join us for a 10-part series, Revival House, and discover the magic of LA's indie theaters. Who knows? You might meet someone.
I know it sounds antithetical because you're just sitting passively, but in fact, you're connecting with everyone else around you.
Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios, wherever you listen to podcasts.
We turn our attention now to the tumultuous change of ownership of Twitter. New book by Kurt Wagner, who covers business and technology and social media for Bloomberg. His book, Battle for the Bird, Jack Dorsey, Elon Musk, and the $44 billion fight for Twitter's soul. Kurt, thank you so much. Good to have you with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So let's get a little bit more information about the cast of characters here, so to speak. I remember years ago, Jack Dorsey came on our program. This is when Twitter was kind of fledgling, and talking about his vision. And he talked less like a business owner than someone who was really, you know, looking at sort of a mission-driven nonprofit kind of entity. And I was struck by that in my conversation with him. You really flesh that out as to what motivated him. Who is Jack Dorsey, the man who starts Twitter?
I think you're right. I think you picked up on exactly what he wanted Twitter to be, which was, you know, not necessarily a big for-profit business, but more of a cultural and social good, right? It was this thing in his mind that he liked to refer to it as the world's global consciousness. And this idea that you might be able to tap into what people are thinking, to, you know, how people feel about a particular issue or an event. And to him, it was, you know, I do think he wishes it had been a nonprofit or it had been some kind of public utility versus a for-profit business. Because as we learned over time, those, you know, the challenges and the pressures that come with being a publicly traded company really started to wear on him, and was one of the things that he thought always held Twitter back.
And what was his view of speech on the platform? Was he fairly much a free speech absolutist, at least at the start?
I think more so than people realized, you know, because Twitter had a lot of rules around what people could and couldn't say, especially as we got into the 2020 year with COVID and then the U.S. election. You know, there really were a ton of rules on Twitter. And I think that, you know, from the outside, employees or observers saw Jack and thought, well, this is just someone who doesn't believe in free speech, or he's stifling free speech. But I think when I've talked to people who worked closely with him, he very much was a free speech advocate internally, one of the probably the biggest ones internally. And I think a lot of the rules that Twitter made actually bothered him. And so, you know, we see that throughout the book, the sort of evolution of Twitter and how Jack thought that the company actually sort of went too far when it came to some of the rules that they created.
So in his friendship with Elon Musk, how does this enter into it? What are their early conversations on the potential for Musk to acquire and take the company private and to sort of return to this free speech ideal that Dorsey had in the early years? Mm-hmm.
So they did have a friendship. They had a relationship before this. And I think it was perhaps a little bit more one-sided. Like I think Jack Dorsey really admired Elon and looked up to him and certainly, you know, wanted him to be involved in this company. And so there's a few parts in the book that I wanted to highlight, you know, for readers as they were getting in, because I think there was this perception that Elon sort of showed up out of the blue. But I don't really think that was the case, because Jack had been talking with Elon for a long time, and there's some great text messages that came out because of a legal situation between the two, the company and Elon, that kind of gives us a glimpse into Jack and Elon's relationship. And, you know, we see that Jack Dorsey was encouraging Elon to you know, participate on the board at Twitter and then eventually to take Twitter private. And I think that was very possible because the two had an existing relationship before that, and because Jack had always admired Elon so much.
We're talking about the history of Twitter, now X, and its change of ownership. Elon Musk, of course, now running X. Jack Dorsey, the founder of Twitter. The book is Battle for the Bird, Jack Dorsey, Elon Musk, and the $44 billion fight for Twitter's soul. Kurt Wagner of Bloomberg, our guest, author of the book. We're at 866-893-5722. You can also ask your question by going to las.com/airtalk, and you have a place right there that you can share your question or comment, or you can email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. So you really talk about this being a battle for Twitter's soul. Is it going to be a nonprofit or privately held or publicly traded, and you know, where advertising dollars are the be all and end all? And we see even with Elon Musk, Kurt, that, you know, he describes himself as a free speech absolutist, but of course then when advertisers flee over the nature of some of the content on Twitter now X, then he seemingly has a change of heart. So elaborate a bit on where Musk seems to be coming from.
I think there's a lot of contradictions between how Elon describes himself and how he says that he views free speech, and then some of the decisions that he actually makes, right? And so, for example, there's a scenario in the book that you were kind of hinting at very shortly after he takes over, where some users are badgering or harassing advertisers on Twitter. And they're basically, you know, trying to get them to stop spending money on the service. And Elon gets so upset that he goes to his head of trust and safety at the company and basically says, we need to start suspending these people, right? If they're attacking our advertisers, we're just going to suspend them. And obviously, you know, people have been protesting against advertisements and advertisers for decades, right? That's not really a new thing. And so they didn't end up doing it, but it gives you a glimpse into how, you know, he says that he really wants free speech and that he's a free speech absolutist. But when, you know, people start to do things that really butt up against his own mission or his own beliefs, you know, he starts to change his mind. And so I think there's a little bit of hypocrisy there. And there's a few examples in the book that I think sort of highlight that.
You also mention his management style and how he's sort of going a million miles a minute compared to Dorsey's, you know, much more sort of deliberate approach, and that the men are kind of opposites in how they led the company. Share with us a bit more about how that, to Musk's detriment, plays into his leadership of X.
Yeah, I think he moves very quickly, and as a result, some of the consequences of those actions end up, you know, coming a little bit faster than had he maybe been more deliberate. I think we saw this, for example, when he started to change Twitter's business model. He really wanted to get into subscriptions. You may recall that he took away sort of the blue check marks that had existed on Twitter, and instead of giving them out sort of for free to notable users on the service, they just started selling them to anyone on the service for $8 a month. And there were a whole bunch of, you know, various issues that came with that. They had to pause the subscription offering because so many people were impersonating famous people and other brands. And it was just, again, an example of him going so quickly, trying to make changes without really thinking them through, that I think got Twitter into trouble early on. And I really think they're still sort of trying to dig themselves out of some of these holes, because the reputation for both Elon and the company took a major hit when he started doing these kinds of things.
One of the points Kurt makes in his book, Battle for the Bird, is about the importance that Twitter, now X, has had in its breaking of news stories, its coverage of news, how it's been such a vital source, but how the removal of the blue check and requiring people to pay for it really made the service less useful as a news entity. We'll continue our conversation with Bloomberg's Kurt Wagner, author of Battle for the Bird, Jack Dorsey, Elon Musk, and the $44 billion fight for Twitter's soul, in just 1 minute. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Kurt Wagner of Bloomberg with us. He covers business and technology, a social media specialty of his, for the several years he's been working at Bloomberg, previously at Recode, at Mashable, and Fortune. Kurt Wagner's book, Battle for the Bird, Jack Dorsey, Elon Musk, and the $44 billion fight for Twitter's soul. One of the points that you make in the book is that Musk has a very difficult time thinking about Twitter being used in ways other than the way he himself uses it for his huge numbers of followers on the social media platform, and that a blind spot was for him was kind of missing its centrality as a source for reliable news, reliable as determined by the blue check, verifying that a particular poster is who that person or that organization purports to be. So do you think Musk understands that now, after he made this decision to remove the blue checks?
I don't think so. My argument in the book, but also just how I believe, as someone who's used Twitter and covered Twitter for a long time, is that the breaking news element of Twitter was really what made it unique and basically what made it necessary and different from, you know, an Instagram or a Facebook or some of these other platforms, was that it really was the place you went when something was happening in the world around you and you needed to know quickly what's going on. And I think by changing the way that verification works, changing the algorithm. The algorithm now surfaces much more, I would call, like, entertaining stuff rather than necessarily the newest stuff. I just think he's made Twitter less valuable as a source of breaking news. And it's a bummer because, again, that was what differentiated the company, in my opinion. And so, you know, this is sort of a use case of one, but I've been on Twitter a long time. I just don't find it as reliable as I used to for these types of things. And as a result, I find that I end up going there less and less. And that's a problem, right? Because that's what Twitter was always best at.
Do we have a sense of how many of the former blue check people decided to pay to keep the blue check versus those who just said, I'm not going to pay for something I got for free before, and then have had, in some cases, accounts that have masqueraded as the original verified account?
Yeah, actually, it's a great question. I don't know the answer to that, but anecdotally, I can say that it feels like a lot. I'll speak for the journalism community, just because that's the group that I'm obviously involved in and that I follow probably most closely. I've seen a lot of journalists sort of just abandon the blue check. You know, they're not willing to pay. And I know that there's a lot of news organizations that have said they're not going to let journalists expense that, right? So they don't see it as a useful tool that journalists should be able to sort of expense to build their reputation or to add validity. Because again, it no longer verifies identity. It just verifies that you put a credit card down to pay $8 a month.
We're talking with Kurt Wagner of Bloomberg, author of Battle for the Bird. So let's quantify, with all the changes Musk has brought to Twitter, now X, how does the number of regular users and the ad revenue for X now compare to what Twitter used to be?
So because X is privately held, they don't do earnings reports like they used to when they were Twitter. So everything that we know is either through reporting or through, you know, what Elon has chosen to share publicly on the platform. So I can talk a little bit about the revenue because I've done some reporting on that for Bloomberg. We know that this was towards the tail end of last year, so the fourth quarter of last year, that the company's goal for 2023 had been about $3 billion in advertising revenue. We think that they were estimated to be closer to $2.5 billion or even less for the year, so they missed that goal. And that would have been about 50%, a little bit more than 50% of the advertising revenue they did 2 years prior, right? So we can pretty safely say that the business is much smaller than it was even just 2 years ago, as advertisers have stopped spending money there. The user growth suffered because Elon likes to tweet and post publicly that, you know, usage is through the roof, but he's using metrics that the company had never used before. So it's a little bit harder to compare, you know, the types of things he's saying publicly with any historical data because he's using completely different metrics and they don't really align and he doesn't really share exactly what some of those metrics mean.
What's your best sense of what he sees as the future of X, given that this sort of wide open, total free speech, uncontrolled language, he's pulled back from that, realizing advertisers are not going to support that, independent of all the criticism. People see that being as harmful to society and to government. So what's the new vision you think that he has?
Well, he's described it as an everything app, and this idea that you would use it not just for posting or getting news, but, you know, watching videos, for making payments, possibly shopping. He's even talked about this idea of, you know, people storing their money there as if it's like an X bank account where they would receive some type of interest for money that's stored with the company. So these are obviously very lofty, ambitious goals that require not only a lot of product changes and you know, approvals from regulators and things, but they would require a total change in how users think about X and how they engage with the product. I don't know about you, but like, I certainly don't think of X as a place that I would ever store my money, right? So if he wants that to actually be the future, he needs to convince people like that this is a completely new company and a completely new product. So that's the vision. I'm pretty skeptical that it's really going to be possible at this point. But he's really pushing to abandon what people think they know about X or formerly Twitter and trying to get them to think about this as a much bigger, more holistic service.
But it seems to me that the challenge that he faces is X/Twitter is so much associated with him, and he is such a polarizing figure, to get any sort of, you know, significant buy-in beyond just the central platform that X is for people who currently find it valuable. How does he do that, given that it's not like it's run by this independent board? It is Elon Musk.
Right. Well, and in fact, there's no board that we're aware of. So, you know, it's not just one guy, but it's one guy without really any checks or advisors, you know, at the board level who might be keeping tabs on the decisions. And so I think that's, you know, that's going to spook off some people. But I where I really have seen this play out is with the advertising business we were talking about. We talked about how much smaller it is today than it was just 2 years ago. From my conversations with advertisers, the biggest thing keeping them away from the company right now is simply Elon's own behavior. Because if you're a major brand, if you're trying to build you know, reputation and you're spending money on X and then suddenly the owner of the company is tweeting things that, you know, people find sexist or misogynistic or racist, it's a huge turnoff and it's a huge risk to those brands to be there. And so until Elon sort of changes his own behavior, I'm not sure that the advertising business will really flourish. And then, as you point out, or we discussed, there's also not really a board or anyone else there to sort of keep checks on him here. He's really doing this very much on his own.
Kurt, thank you so much for being with us and talking about your fascinating book on the battle for the bird, about Jack Dorsey, Elon Musk, and Twitter. Thank you for being with us. We appreciate it very much.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Kurt Wagner of Bloomberg, where he covers social media, is an award-winning business and tech journalist for Bloomberg. Battle for the Bird is the title of his book. Coming up next, continuing coverage from NPR on Here and Now of this morning's passage of a bill in the House, bipartisan passage of a bill that would ban TikTok within the United States. It moves on to the Senate next. You'll hear more coverage of that. Have a great day from all of us at AirTalk.